Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. Coming up tonight, 24% of the vote, 100 fewer councillors, two ministerial resignations.
We will redouble our efforts over the next 2 years to prove that politics can actually work. And these areas identified as really sore points are ones for government to knuckle down and deal with. And I hope that we can do that in the time ahead.
The challenges facing Enda Kenny. Our Late Debate tonight after the news from Eileen Whelan.
Good evening. A spokesperson for the Bon Secours Sisters has said members of the order will take part in any investigation into the mother and baby home in County Galway. Almost 800 children died at St Mary's Home in Toom, which the sisters operated from 1925 to 1961. The Taoiseach has said the government is gathering information to decide how to proceed with the revelations. Enda Kenny said he wanted to know the exact scale of the situation in Toom and whether there were similar mass graves around the country. The historian Catherine Corliss, who carried out the research on Toom, said she had received many queries about the home.
Because of this media coverage and because of the Toom home being highlighted, I've been inundated with requests from people telling me they had a brother or sister that died in the home. Could I check the list to see are they in that plot? They think this story is so sad. It has touched the heart of everyone. Mm-hmm. But the whole world believes that this is an injustice to these children and they must be recognised.
Two men have been killed in a collision between two motorcycles near Listunvarna in County Clare. Gardaí say the crash happened on the Ennis-Diamond Road at about 7:15 this evening. A woman passenger on one of the bikes was taken to hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. The road has been closed for forensic examination and diversions are in place. The rehab group has lost its High Court challenge to the decision of the Minister for Justice to abolish the charitable lottery scheme. The scheme was set up to compensate charitable lotteries whose prize funds were capped to protect sales of the National Lottery. In its judgment, the court said the Minister for Justice and advisers had simply concluded that the scheme was not a justifiable use of public money. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has held talks with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Paris about the crisis in Ukraine. Mr. Cameron said he told Mr. Putin that the current situation was not acceptable. The meeting took place after the leaders of the G7, the group of industrialised nations, warned that Russia could face damaging economic sanctions unless it changed course. The weather forecast: showers over parts of Ulster will die out and it'll be mainly dry in most other areas. Rain will develop over South Munster later and winds will increase there. Lowest temperatures 5 to 10 degrees. Windy over Munster tomorrow with heavy and possibly thundery rain leading to spot flooding, and the rain will extend gradually northwards as the day goes on. And that's all for now. News again here on Radio 1 at 11. But now it's back to The Late Debate.
Eileen, thank you very much indeed, and you're very welcome back to the programme. Tonight we're focusing on Fine Gael in the aftermath of last week's elections. Their electoral performance got a little lost in the coverage of Labour's massive losses and Sinn Féin and Independence big gains. They lost more than 100 councillors and their vote fell by 14%. So tonight we'll examine what went wrong for the party, the challenges facing Enda Kenny as leader and Taoiseach, and will he even stay in the job? I'm joined tonight in studio by Anthony Lawler, Fine Gael TD for Kildare North, who was mentioned as part of a group of backbench TDs who want a number of ministers sacked in the upcoming cabinet reshuffle. Also here, former Fine Gael Justice Minister Nora Owen. Konstantin Gurdjieff is Professor of Finance at Trinity College, and Michael O'Regan is Parliamentary Correspondent with the Irish Times. And you're all very welcome to the programme. Anthony Lawler, first of all, who is costing the party votes?
Who is costing the party votes at the moment? I suppose it's a midterm election. We've had 3 years of difficult decisions to make. And as a result of that, the people have decided maybe to give us a kick in the rear end, that the measures that we put in place are for the good of the economy, and we have to listen to the people now. And so from that perspective, I think all the policies that we've implemented, which have been difficult on the people, and they've made us realise, sit up and realise that we have to start listening to them. So it's a combination of a number of things that has
caused. Would new faces at the cabinet table make a big difference?
Well, that's a decision for the Taoiseach to make with regard to a reshuffle. He's already indicated that something will happen. We've lost a number of ministers, the leader of the Labour Party and our own Brian Hayes too as well. So there is scope for the Taoiseach to make a reshuffle with regard to that too as well. And it is good for revitalisation of both the government and the party itself, that we have a couple of changes in faces.
Have you and others made it clear that there are specific people in cabinet and outside of cabinet as well, but very senior in the party, who you want replaced?
No, I don't think any of us have made it clear as to what we would like to see happen. Some people individually have said that they would like to see a major reshuffle. I myself would like to see certain personnel that need to be changed, either moved on to different departments, or because there's scope there for, there's a lot of younger, enthusiastic backbenchers
who have a lot of experience. Who do you think should be moved on at this point?
I'm not saying anyone, I can't say specifically anyone in particular, but I would like to see some of the younger faces come forward.
You can't say, or you won't say tonight?
I won't say who, because that's obviously a matter for the Taoiseach to make a decision on. I myself feel that there will be a reshuffle, there will be changes made, there is scope for the Taoiseach to do that, and there is an opportunity for some of the younger and newer TDs to get promoted in this reshuffle.
The reports are that it's James Riley, Phil Hogan, Jimmy D. And would those reports be off the mark?
This is a sort of a list that was made a fictional list by Danny McConnell and the Independent.
It's
purely fictional. It's nice to see the Independent going fictional at last.
Michael O'Regan, do you think it's purely fictional?
Well, it's speculative, let's say. And that media, nobody knows this except the Taoiseach. And I suspect that 3,000 miles away, he mightn't even know himself yet. This is going to be a difficult one for him, because there are no obvious people to take out of the cabinet and no obvious people to leave there. I mean, Leo Varadkar, I think, is now regarded as quite a success. Some of the reasons for that, I think, is that he has tended to speak his mind. For instance, he was very sympathetic to the whistleblowers very early on, when it was neither profitable nor popular among some of his colleagues. And for other reasons, he has spoken his mind. But if you look at this cabinet, there are no obvious people to take out, there are obvious people to promote. But
some people would say James Riley is an obvious person to take out. Phil Hogan's an obvious person to take out.
The problem here, Audrey, is this with James Riley, is it's easy to scapegoat a minister in Angola, as Brian Cowan famously described the Department of Health. And James Riley was right when he told the Fine Gael parliamentary party last night that he had not received the support of some ministers on the medical card issue. This was a cabinet decision for months.
To review the medical cards.
To review the medical cards.
But medical cards were being taken off people long before the review was being announced.
But that's the point I'm making. But the Taoiseach knew about it. He was asked at opposition leaders questions about it. The Taoiseach knew about it. Other ministers were asked in the Dáil about it. Time and again, they rattled off a series of statistics about the number of medical cards made available to people, prepared for them by a civil servant. And this was a cabinet decision not to do anything about it until they were hammered in the elections. And then suddenly, they saw the light. But the problem with the department...
So did James Riley not want to have a review of medical cards?
I don't know that. If Fine Gael thinks that taking James Riley out of the Department of Health and maybe putting him into another ministry is going to solve the problems for this government, I mean, they're very, very wrong.
That is taken. But do you not get a sense, Michael, that James Riley wants to go?
I suspect at this stage that he might like a move himself. But it's interesting that it took a lot of controversy surrounding the Department of Justice to set up a group to examine how this department works. Surely the Department of Health and the HSE, the utterly dysfunctional, require a similar group. And I suspect that if James Riley is moved, and I think he probably will be, I don't know, but I think he probably will be, and somebody else is put in there, they too will encounter banana skins. I mean, can anybody name a successful Minister for Health in relatively recent times? Do you have to go back to Noel Brown in the 1940s? Charlie Haughey gave out toothbrushes, I think, in the 70s. Charles Haughey in the 1980s, as Taoiseach, said he wasn't aware of the scale of the health cutbacks.
Remember the ads?
Yeah, indeed. Disowning his then minister, Dr. Rory O'Hanlon. So to go back and pick out a very, very successful minister going back over decades, you can't do it, which suggests that the Department of Health is utterly dysfunctional and requires the kind of analysis which the Department of Justice is belatedly getting from this expert group.
Would Dr. Leo Varadkar not be an obvious choice for health?
No, and I have said many times on radio and on television that I'm not exactly a great fan of a lawyer in justice and a doctor in health. they can bring their own problems with them. If you're a lawyer in justice, there's a feeling among staff, I think, that they can't really tell you things because they assume you know it, and you might feel insulted if they start to explain something to you. I remember when I went into justice, I said to them, now, I'm not a lawyer, so don't be using words that I mightn't understand. If I don't understand it, I can't explain it to somebody else. And I said, that's your job now, to make me understand what proposals and what the implications are of them. In a doctor in health sometimes runs into problems because they go in feeling they know the whole scene. James hasn't actually had a great run with his own colleagues, medical doctors, because every time he tries to do something, they seem to hit him. And Michael is right, just changing the personnel. I think at this stage, James is probably getting tired, if that's the right word, realising that, you know, it's very hard to change the Department of Health. He's tried to do things like change the structures. Mary Harney tried to change the structures and it was going to be the be all and end all, and it wasn't. James Riley is trying to change the structures again, bringing it more back into the answerability in the department. People aren't happy with that either. So But nonetheless, I think Enda Kenny's natural conservatism is going to have to be shaken somewhat, because I do think the changes that he's going to have to make are going to have to be a bit more radical.
Do you agree with Anthony that there are faces there who just have to go?
Well, no, I don't think it should be so much faces that people have to leave, but I think certainly portfolios need to be changed, I think, to give a freshness and to, you know, get the public re-engaged, because as long as they are as disengaged as they are, and remember Fine Gael had a bad local election, we can't second guess that, 115 seats lost, very good sitting councillors lost their seats, and very good new candidates failed to get elected, not through their own fault. And it's tough on a new candidate who comes in, puts themselves forward in a party that's in government, and then finds they don't get elected, and the challenge will be to keep some of those people in the mix still in Fine Gael. But, you know, what happened too was that in a lot of the areas where Fine Gael would have got a good vote, the turnout was poor. I saw it in the constituency of North Dublin, or Fingal as it's called now, places where we usually were 3 and 4 and 5 percentage points above the average for turnout.
And is that a party machine problem?
That was a party machine, and it was people in Fine Gael and people who would normally vote for Fine Gael, and indeed even for Fianna Fáil, saying, I'm not going as far as voting for an independent who has a background in a whole lot of parties, or Sinn Féin, or the People Before Profit, or any of those. But I am giving the government a bit of a kick, and I'm not going to go out. And I saw it myself. I spoke to people who said, oh, look, the children were sick or something happened, my granny called, and I just didn't bother going out to vote. Mm-hmm. They'll vote in a general election. And the challenge now for Enda is to find a way in which he can revitalise the government. It has been in a sense of drift since the Troika went. The Troika kept, I mean, Enda's great skill during all the Troika, and that was he had a calming influence on the people, along with Michael Noonan and Brendan Howland and lots of the other ministers. So it's not fair to just say, well, we'll throw out a minister. Alan Shatter resigned because things got so fraught. But you know, James Riley is in a department like health and justice. They're both demand led. Mm-hmm. You can't decide how many prisoners you're going to have for prisons. You can't decide how many people are going to get sick. You can't say to people, would you ever hold off getting sick for a year or two until we get the finances right? It's a demand led department. And every day that I'd say James Riley gets up, he probably gets a shock when something that was moving in the right direction suddenly slips back again. You know, it can be the winter flu, it can be something like that.
Constantine, Ivan Yates, writing in the Irish Independent today, it says, riddance of the tiresome trio, Shatter, Hogan and Riley, will be perceived as a masterful game changer in reversing dissatisfaction ratings against the government. Would you agree?
I tend to disagree with that view. I don't think it is about personalities. It is about the government. First of all, if you look at the elections result, I think a lot of the 14% of the voters lost by Fine Gael are swing voters from the previous elections, which shouldn't be in the first place with Fine Gael, or wouldn't be in normal circumstances. I think the real hammering has been taken by the Labour, who lost their core votes, rather than Fine Gael lost some of the core votes, but maybe due to apathy, as Nora is saying, but also, of course, due to the dissatisfaction. The real weak point of the government right now, there are two weak points, major ones. The one on composition of the government is Labour Party. There is absolutely no way I can see Fine Gael gaining ideas putting those ideas forward and gaining foothold in terms of any sort of the reforms as long as they're in bed with a Labour Party. The second one is, of course, Labour Party is leading the inducing instability into coalition currently because during their own selection processes and their own navel gazing, if you want, there is certainly a possibility that they will bring down the government at a certain point in time. And the bigger problem as well is a longer-term problem, something that Nora hinted on, is the fact that the coalition is very tired already. Now, it's tired for good reason. It's done a lot, and it was a very hard job, but it was a job of an undertaker. It wasn't the job of leadership. And now we're discovering that the entire cabinet, and it's not just people on the side of the Labour, but also some people on Fine Gael's side, are simply devoid of ideas. And on top of everything, when they do get ideas, such as, for example, last year they had a pretty good document, policy document on entrepreneurship. They had pretty good document in terms of the health strategies and all. They lack leadership to implement those. So if you look at the core reforms where even the easy, fruit can be picked still, the likes of Quangos. The Onboard SNPno report in 2009 identified 870 Quangos in this country. Mm-hmm. Fine Gael came into power with a promise, solemn promise, of abolishing 100 of them. They shut down 45. They opened 33 new ones since then. Now, that's not a sign of leadership. It doesn't matter whether you change ministers and you change portfolios. That's not going to lead to a hell of a lot. What you need to do is you need to bring people with new ideas. And the problem then becomes, where are those people? Are those people in the backbench? You mentioned, for example, Leo Varadkar, who's been throughout the process of governing currently as a minister in the current government, certainly been outspoken. He's been speaking his own mind. It gained him a lot of recognition. It gained him a lot of bruises as well, but it gained him a lot of recognition as well. But how many Leo Varadkars are there? One of the probably leading minds in Fine Gael government, Alan Shatter, who actually had very good ideas, who had a certain degree of leadership, who quietly was working very hard behind the scenes on the very major reforms as well, he fell on a sort of public relations, effectively, and been thrown under the bus by his own colleagues. If you look at the economic policies, there's nothing but undertaking which is taking place there right now, and I don't think they're going to have a room for anything other than that.
But the argument that keeps coming up is that the government hasn't been listening, and there's no doubt that what transpired during the election and the issues, some of those issues were being raised. And I know Tony can probably give us a bigger idea of that, but I know there's a system in place where backbench TDs are asked to submit the three issues that came up that week, the three most significant issues that came up when they were canvassing, or just week to week, and to bring them in. So it's not as if the government ministers didn't know. But the danger always is that when you're a government minister, you're kind of so caught up in the things of the department and in the money situation. I mean, there isn't money to be thrown at things. Remember when Fianna Fáil were in office at a certain stage, every single thing that was raised in the Dáil that seemed to be a problem, by the next day they were announcing a fistful of money being thrown at it. That just isn't there. So the government has to listen now, and Enda has to kind of take a grip on things and get that leadership role again that he has given in a calm, quiet way over the last 3 years.
I think, listening for the government is important. It's imperative for every politician to listen. The problem with current government is that I don't know what you can do for them to listen. They actually seem to reflect the view that they actually do listen and have some idea. For example, Enda Kenny nonstop talks about jobs and the need for jobs creation. And yet he turns around and does absolutely nothing on that front. Or when he does something, it is half finished. It's never really completed. He knows that we need domestic demand stimulation in some way or another, improvement in domestic demand. He turns around and keeps talking about FDI and exports. So either he's getting wrong advice or he is listening and not getting the idea, not getting the actual message. Look at the topics. These topics have been all around us before. We know we are starved of investment domestically. That's been with the previous government as well as with this one. We know the mortgages arrears are still the problem, and it actually not going away at any appreciable rate. Latest statistics show that actually overall the number of mortgages at risk of default or in default has gone up again in quarter on quarter, despite the fact that the central bank keeps taking the mortgages out on a superficial basis and ships them off to the United States effectively. We also have, what other issues we have? We have banks debt. That issue has been hanging over us with the seismic announcements left, right, and center by the government, and nothing delivered on it. So I don't know. It's not about listening. It's about start to deliver.
Tony, you want in there to defend.
I agree about the whole point about listening. And I suppose from my perspective as a backbencher, as what Nora said, we have been highlighting those issues for probably the last 6 months that have come up on the doorstep.
So what, you were telling senior ministers at the PP meetings,
we were saying what was coming on. And the problem is that, obviously, from our perspective going forward, we have a real opportunity as backbenchers to have much more of an influence now because of the start listening to us, because we're really a conduit for the people that we meet on a day-to-day basis. From the economic point of view, like the domestic economy, the VAT receipts are up this month, the exchequer returns are quite good, although 1 month doesn't highlight it's going to happen on an annual basis. It is looking quite positive from that perspective. And as we're going into the budgetary process, it is an opportunity again for us, I know, as backbenchers. We've never had much of a role in the budgetary process, and I think it's time that government started taking us on board, because, as I said earlier on, we are actually listening to the people on the ground. We have a feeling as what is needed, and we've been saying that to government for the last 6, 8, 9 months.
They're not listening.
And that's the point that I've been saying all along, is that the people, the Taoiseach has admitted that he hasn't been listening to the people, and we're a conjugate for the people.
And why,
so
why is that, Michael? Is it an arrogance? Is it, what is it?
It's a complacency. I mean, nothing defined the complacency that seemed to grip this government as the medical card fiasco, where you had horrendous cases presented to the entire cabinet, by the way, not just James Riley. Terrible cases raised and dismissed effectively over a period of months. And it took a hammering in the elections for this cabinet to realise that there were terrible cases of human suffering out there because of the withdrawal of discretionary medical cards. I think part of it is that Fine Gael and Labour, particularly ministers, they seem to think that they got a massive endorsement from the Irish people at the election. They didn't. Fianna Fáil was hammered. So if you hammer Fianna Fáil, you have to elect a government. Hence, Fine Gael and Labour gained from the hammering that Fianna Fáil got. And there's been a lot of old nonsense talked about a national government. It's not. It's a Fine Gael-Labour coalition with a big majority. And this hullabaloo they had, you know, this jamboree in government buildings, in front of government buildings they had when the Troika left, and an orgy of self-congratulation in the Dáil. Self-congratulatory speeches in the Dáil. And then they all disappear on junkets. Not all of them were junkets. A lot of them were. They all disappear for St. Patrick's Day. Mm. Some of them spent a week abroad meeting the diaspora. Most of the diaspora forced out of this country don't want to meet politicians because they blame politicians for forcing them to immigrate. So maybe if more of them stay at home next St. Patrick's Day, if they're still around, and apply themselves to their departmental work, they won't end up in the mess they currently find themselves in the aftermath of the elections.
But I think, Michael, if the government is to get to grips, first of all, the Labour leadership thing is kind of a bit of business that has to be completed, and it'll certainly cause a certain amount of discussion for the next month. It's hard to say, you know, where it'll eventually, who the eventual winner will be, although I have my own views as to who I think will win it. But I mean, that has to be got over with. But in the meantime, Enda Kenny and his ministers must sit down and say, it wasn't sometimes the policies that the public didn't want. It was the way they were handled. There was a certain incompetence. Even if you take the water situation, like, we didn't have, the government didn't have all their, if you pardon the pun, their ducks in a row about the water. So they should have been firm in saying, we are not going to speculate or give you half information. We don't know until the whole system is set up, which will be about August. And that's what Enda said originally, be about August. And then he got forced in the Dáil to say, well, I'll tell you as much as I can before the election. So then all the questions began to arise. Who'll get the waiver? How many gallons of water or litres of water will I get? And most of them were calling them gallons still. And I remember back in 1986 when Garrett decided to do the first divorce referendum, and I was on the subcommittee with Peter Barry and others to kind of organise that. We put that out as a piece of legislation and put it to the country. And within about 3 days, we realised we didn't have all the answers and the information. Who would get the widow's pension? Would there be two widow's pensions? All those kind of questions. And the referendum failed because we hadn't got everything We hadn't got the answers. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, we had the answers and it was carried. With the water, it should have been left there until we knew exactly who would get a waiver and who wouldn't, and how many litres everybody would get. And then you wouldn't have had all this speculation about people having their water cut off and people not being able to bathe their children and all that sort of thing. That was sort of incompetent in a way. Competence is a...
I agree, Nora. It is incompetence, yes. But this
that's
is
what
almost
people at
but
the
no,
doors.
I think that's what I think what's affecting people at the doors is that 500 million euro will have to go out of their pockets to pay for something that they've been already taxed for. And what then the next thing which affects them is the gross degree of effectively incompetence in management that is being seen to kind of be created around the issue of water here, both from the policy point of view and from application point of view. The bills for consultancies, for example, coming up front. And that, of course, reinforces the issue of that 500 million or whatever is going to has to go out of our pockets as well. The fact that, for example, the staff there is receiving bonuses. The fact that the leadership of the company is having a track record on other projects which are with similar overruns have been handled and haven't been delivered as well. So there is a whole layers
of the thing.
It's a management. It's a management.
I mean, I think if you scratch most people, they understand that the time has come where we probably do have to pay for our water.
Of course.
But when they see all the kind of messing that goes around us.
But also, they also are aware that paying for the water is one thing. Paying for the water twice, like we do with healthcare, for example, in terms of the private insurance, where we're paying on the double effectively and we have the two-tier system, which is, you know, funded by one tier. I mean, we have mismanagement across the board in this system. And the fact that we have the government, which is the caretaker government, which has the policies directed to it in major policies, macroeconomic policies directed to it from external side, would give you some confidence that they at least would have time and effort to be devoted to the smaller details of managing things. Again, the medical cards came up, discretionary medical cards, exactly the same fiasco as with medical cards over 70s that Fianna Fáil has lived through. Again, no lessons learned. Again, most of the people would say, sure, that you know, check the system, make sure that people don't game the system, there is no abuse and everything, but do it transparently, do it organically, and do it with such a way that people who are in real need don't get thrown out of the bus.
Tony Lawler.
I actually think what one of the key issues, again, is what you're bringing up, Constantine, and Nora has brought up, is the fact, one of all listening to a role for backbenchers in government, some way or another. A lot of us have been calling for more openness and transparency within government. I think it's more important that we have a much more positive say, because we all have capacities or capabilities in our own right. We all have certain technical skills, certain qualifications, and we are the conduit from people who are able to tell us on the street what should be done.
But did you find, Tony, that the water issue, I mean, it was coming up at the doors and the shopping centres, that it was because people didn't really know, they feel they had to pay for water, but it's this nonsense of will we get so this and that, and it wasn't properly spelt out. Yeah, and that's incompetence more than the policy.
Yeah, I think the whole issue started from day one. And I agree with most people out there don't have a problem with paying for water. I see we're all drinking bottled water here. I don't know why we're not drinking tap water, because tap water is as good
sure
as bottled.
Sure, Tony, that they don't have a problem, but I think they do. I mean, I think they have a major problem in the sense that people are punch drunk from austerity. And here they're paying, and they were told by Labour in advance of the election that there would be no water charges if Labour got into power. I think they have a growing problem with the fact that people have now witnessed several years of austerity. They were kind of half promised, not least at the Fine Gael Ardèche, tax concessions for middle to lower income. Where the money was going to come from, nobody was quite sure. And now, people don't really know where they stand.
But I would say at the very start, we said we would try and broaden the tax base, put in something that's sustainable for the long-term future of the country. And a lot of us would feel that that's the way forward. Now, I accept the fact we've gone on for almost 7 budgets now, 4 brought in by Fianna Fáil, 3 by ourselves, with regard who have cut money out of the economy. It is actually time now to look at where we actually can target specific areas, and whether we have the funding for it this year or not, whether we have to bring in a neutral budget, I would hope the economic data that's been out in the last couple of days will continue on for the rest of the year. It will give us scope. But the worry is we don't know what international shock might come. We have to cushion ourselves, and that's why it is important that we have a good broad tax base to be able to keep make sure the deficit down below 3% so as we can fund ourselves here. And with regard to water again, I've always believed that we should pay for water. It's a resource that costs an awful lot of money to produce and bring to the people. And what will happen is, and I hope to as well, is that people will actually see that there is ways in which we can change our usage of water and how it's been used.
All right, Constantine, you want to?
I think there's a lot of that comes from the good intentions, and I can understand them. But the problem is that we didn't create a sustainable tax system. Our system was unsustainable because a lot of it was geared towards the property taxation, one source of the taxation.
That's in the past now.
Yes, correct,
right.
Correct. So
sure
what the two consecutive governments, the Fianna Fáil government with the Greens and the Fianna Gael Labour government have done is that they shifted the imbalance away from property taxation and capital taxation onto the income taxation. So we have now the most imbalanced since 1970s system of taxation.
And where
once
could they
again.
Have gone to?
Well, you have to spread. Okay, fine, you could have spread it. For example, there was a very good proposal, which Troika, by the way, accepted and was in the program for government, the land value taxation instead of the property taxation. Mm. That's a broader base. Excuse me, it is. It includes all of the forms of property rather than particular residential properties. Rather
didn't
than hitting just families.
Didn't they run into a constitutional problem on that?
I don't know. No, they
about
didn't,
land
actually.
Ownership.
There was absolutely no constitutional problem, as far as I'm aware. All of the official documents which have been released in the public are simply shouted down on the basis it's a bit too difficult for us to do. That was the argument which was produced by the department. That was the argument by the Taxation Commission. It was laughable, simply, because there was a lot of research showing that it is very easy to do. There was a lot of academics who did research showing
that.
The
tax system we're putting in now is a much more sustainable one going
not.
For.
They're
rather
not
than
more sustainable.
The
property-based
tax
taken,
system
no,
that was
they
in
are
there
not.
Under the Fianna
they're
Fáil
taking
governments.
Money. They're taking money out of people who are working for a living day after day after day, and they're not taking money out of people who are sitting on the inheritance. They're not taking money out of the landed gentry in this country. They're taking money out of the ordinary workers, and those ordinary workers are paying mortgages. They're stretched beyond any belief. They're also capital gains tax, yes, but this government brought, by the way, the capital gains tax exemption for property held over 7 years. Commercial property, once again.
That was a stimulated.
Oh, yes,
of
course. So we're back to I'm sorry.
That's finished up this year. That finishes up this year.
Well, we don't know if ministers
in
going to renew
to the Minister
it
of
or
Finance,
not.
He brought in.
Okay,
he
just
wants,
one voice. Just let Tony, I'll bring you in.
In fairness to the Minister of Finance, he brought in targeted, specific tax incentives to stimulate the sale of property, the upward movement, the movement of property. And he's always consistently done that. He's done it on the hospitality sector. He's done it that. He did it on the small building sector last year for home improvements and home grant. So, like, this is what the key part about it is that you put them in to stimulate them, and then once it's stimulated, you finish it.
Commercial property purchases, which were stimulated by this tax break, have gone to the foreign investment funds, who anticipate 25% gain without tax breaks in this country a year. Do you realize that this is beyond the vultures? These guys are actually sitting here and expecting to double their money every 3 years. Some of them are so anxious right now to sell that they're trying to get into the market to flip the property which they bought about a year ago. And they don't care about those tax breaks. That's the whole point. It hasn't been successful. It doesn't deliver. But by and large, it certainly, that particular tax break certainly does not create or is not consistent with an approach of creating a sustainable tax system. And sustainable tax system would start taxing those inputs into production and those forms of capital first, which are least productive. And the least productive one in Ireland is property. Tax heavier that, and tax less heavy the most productive. Our labor, our skills, our knowledge, our younger people.
Well, we haven't taxed work. We haven't
We
haven't
increased the minimum
income
wage
tax.
Was increased.
Yeah.
How much taxation has gone from the upper marginal tax rate of 42% under the pre-crisis scenario to 55% upper marginal tax rate right now on self-employed with a certain income? That is not an increase in taxation.
But isn't the bulk of our tax take coming in from a very small percentage of the very well
correct.
Off?
Correct. At the most top.
At
yes.
the most top. So
absolutely.
But I mean, like, unfortunately, this discussion will, and all of us will think, will lead people to think that there is some kind of magic bullet or magic wand or whatever phrase you want to use, that somehow the government now can turn around and begin to give out the goodies and what have you. We can't. We are still strapped. We are still that's borrowing true. More than we're taking
in. Well, that's what
in.
I'm going to ask you, Michael.
And we have to recognise that. So what you can offer to the electorate is to do things better, with more compassion, with more competence, but try to explain to them that if we do this now, this is where it lead. And in fairness to James Riley, because I've heard him many, many times speaking, he went into health saying, I do want to change the system so we have a better delivery of health services to our people. Mm-hmm. It's taking longer, and I know how hard it is to turn around any policy. The minute a new policy is suggested, you go back into a department and they give you 50 reasons why it can't be done and one reason why it might be done.
And Michael, the budget coming up in October, will that be a big challenge for Endicenny? Will he plough on with what the European Commission want?
I think he will want to do that, but I mean, if you listen to Joan Burton and Alex White, the two contenders for the Labour leadership, they're talking another language at the moment. Now, maybe that's the language that you talk when you're trying to get elected leader of your party. Mm. You know, they're addressing if the 5,000 or so members of the Labour Party will be voting in this. But they're certainly talking about an easing of austerity. Sometimes when you listen to them, they're talking about what appears to be a significant easing of austerity. Yet, and Nora's right, we're getting very different signals from Brussels. I think it's this. As soon as the Labour leadership is over and you have a Taoiseach and you have a reshuffled cabinet, I think the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach should tell the Irish people the facts. Well in advance of the budget, that this is the economic situation, and stop half promising things like this promise that started, this half promise that started from Labour and Fine Gael, about 2 months before the elections. It was kind of half thrown out there, and then of course there was always the rider if economic circumstances allow, and then you had announcement after announcement by the government in the run up to the elections. This is a government that promised us nothing short of a democratic revolution. It was the old politics, you know. You promise as much as you can in the run up to elections, in the hope that you do as well as possible. And of course, the Irish people clearly rejected that kind of politics. But it's really up to Endicenny and the new Taoiseach to tell us fairly soon after the cabinet reshuffle and tell the Irish people. And Nora's right. Actually, I think that when this government came in, it had a lot of goodwill. Nobody expected an economic miracle overnight. But what people demanded was hard work and competence. Mm-hmm. They got that for a while and then it disappeared.
And Michael, what about as part of the reshuffle, Fine Gael appointing Brendan Howlin as finance minister? As a bargaining chip to Labour staying in government for the next 2 years?
No, I think Michael Noonan will remain as finance minister, but I think, and I'd be certain of this, that Brendan Howlin will remain as minister for public expenditure and reform. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Joan Burton camps and the Alex White camps are saying that he will be left there.
And there's nothing in it for Labour to pull the plug on the government. They also have to try to hope that in the 2.5 years that's left, things will have changed. There'll be more money from the banks for small and medium sized industries. There'll be more, possibility of, you know, correcting some of the hardships and the austerity that they had to put on people. But, you know, I lived through the 80s and I was in the back benches like Tony in the 80s, and it was a very hard time and all sorts of things were being looked at. I mean, the free travel, everything was under threat. Mm. We survived that and we kind of came out of it gradually. I think people went into this recession on a slightly higher level. There's still lots of very poor people. There's still lots of people who are struggling and who will find that, you know, paying the bills. The property tax is one that has kind of disappeared off the agenda, but I think it will come back more. What I heard from people were elderly couples who happen to have a good house and they're paying a property tax that's three times what their friends or cousins or their elderly aunts are paying in a country house or country town. And, you know, they're paying 1,100 or 1,200 a year, and they're telling me about people with 4 acres around their house paying 500 or 600. Mm-hmm. That creates a really unfair
society. That's why the land value tax would have been
better. I mean, I agree. I thought the land value idea was a good one, but I think it ran into problems with constitution. So, you know, it does take time to work out the creaks in these kind of systems. And it's wrong that somebody, because they happened to at one stage either inherit or buy a house that was in a big city that it happened to have four bedrooms and might be three story, but now there's an elderly couple living in it with just the pension. How are they going to pay that?
There's opportunities, obviously. Tony. with the change in local government,
yes,
new people coming into local government to reassess the property tax within each county, each borough too, as well, to make decisions on that, and that's a welcome decision. That it's given more power back to local councillors, which I come from a council background, and I would have been a councillor for a number of years, and this is the sort of thing that I'm almost jealous of the councillors who are sitting around now in the next year, where they'll be discussing their budget. They'll have much more of an input into their own local authority budget than I will have into the national budget.
And do you think
they'll
be able to reduce the property tax in some places? I know there's rumours that they mightn't be. Yeah, 15% is the maximum they can reduce.
15% is the max they can do. But they'll have to look, they'll all actually have to look at their own budgets and see what they actually
can
do.
Which are all under pressure.
The real difference between the 1980s and today is only one word: debt. In 1980s, household debt was a fraction of what it is right now, relative to the economy, relative to household budgets. It is a massive problem, and nothing effectively is being done to it. Today's figures are shambolic in terms of the mortgages arrears. The reductions are tiny in terms of the principal residences, increases in 720 days and over arrears, very significant on buy-to-lets, for example, almost 9%, if I remember correctly, 2% for the, oh, sorry, 5% increase in terms of the over 720 days arrears in terms of the primary residences. Overall, mortgages continue to be a huge problem. The government has tried, took a bite at it. Pretty much everything that has been put in place so far is not quite working. A lot of change will be required. But in reality, if I think, you know, the government were to do something, it needs to start bragging less about its achievements, in inverted commas. It needs to start promising less, because it wouldn't be able to deliver it. Even if the best scenarios of forecast, and by the way, we keep talking about the budget, we don't even have the first quarter figures in terms of the growth right now. So everything is academic at this stage. So even if the best forecast that I have seen will materialize, the government will have an ability to reduce the next wave of austerity by perhaps 300 million. That assumes that the Department of Health stays where it is right now. In the first 5 months of this year, Department of Health has managed to overspend on the current expenditure side. This is not capital. That's not building new hospital rooms or facilities or buying new equipment. On current side, by 156 million in 5 months. Half of whatever room there was as well.
That's also reduced.
See, a demand-led department, Constantine. You can't oversimplify.
This is not about oversimplification. What I'm saying is that there is no margin even right now to make an argument about
a little bit better than what you're saying.
Any changes. Well, look, I mean, that's actually his net figures, by the way. What you're talking about is that they managed to save 12 million on the side of the capital expenditure. That's why I said carefully that it's current expenditure, okay? But the capital expenditure is timing issues, okay? You have commitments in terms of capital. We might actually have an overspend there as well. But that's, anyways, it doesn't really matter. What I'm saying is that there is that amount of the cushion that we have in terms of playing with the budget, even in theoretical constraints today, before we have the actual numbers, is tiny, completely tiny. It's not going to make any material difference. So the government needs to actually stop bragging and stop promising, and it needs to start delivering of even the small things that are actually tangible, concrete and exact in themselves.
But don't we as a people also need to face the reality too, that for some people life has returned to a better place? I mean, I was talking to somebody who was celebrating an anniversary, and they were ringing up hotels to get somewhere, and they couldn't get a hotel because they were already all booked out. You look at
surely
the concert.
There must be some Nama Shack somewhere. There's a few spare rooms.
You look at the One Direction concert. The count for the local election was out in the City West, which has terrible connotations for me because that's where I fell on my e-voting machine. And but the place was full of mammies and daddies and 5 and 6 year olds who were staying the night there, and then they were getting buses down to the Croke Park, to the One Direction. 5 sell-out concerts at I don't know how much a ticket, 60 or 70 euros a ticket. So there is movement in there, and there are people getting...
But the reverse of that is, for a lot of people, it hasn't improved at all.
No, I realise that.
For a lot of people,
yes,
it's worse.
Well, I wonder how worse it is. I mean, the social welfare budget is huge. The welfare budget on paying tenancy, paying for rent, people forced to immigrate. Yeah. Well, people forced to immigrate,
which is the ultimate betrayal. I mean, we now have a situation in this country where, and you can't scapegoat the current government for this, where if you look at it, you can't guarantee anyone a job. If you have a problem with housing, you can't guarantee anyone even decent accommodation. I was watching the Late Late Show recently where they had an item on housing and they were interviewing women and children who were in what Ryan Turbidy rightly described as tenements, reminiscent of what Sean O'Casey used to write about it. And the other thing, of course, is mass forced immigration. Three areas where this republic has failed utterly.
But the housing building programme completely died in the last 3 or 4 years. Yeah, isn't that right, Tony? It died.
I'll be honest with you on that. And this stems from, we talk about something has to be done on the housing sector in this budget because it's not about trying to create a situation for first-time buyers where they get the funds. It's more about supply of housing. Mm-hmm. And if we can get the supply of housing, currently at the moment there's only 8,000 houses being built. There is a need, the ERSI have said, there's a need between 20 and 25,000 houses. It's an area, there's 60,000 people unemployed who have the building skills out there too as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a real area where we could look at in the budget going forward, that we can, on the supply side, it's more on the supply side that we should, and particularly us in the backbenchers, the CIFF, I've met with them recently, they've come up with a couple of good ideas which may help, again, on the supply side, to create, not only create jobs, but also give permanent homes for all those people in the house.
But we can't return to 100% mortgages and that kind of thing, because that's
actually, there's something in Canada at the moment where an idea might be that if you can give 80% mortgage with the other 20% is savings, but you bring in a sort of a SSIA scheme for that 20% saving, where if I'm saving, the government gives an incentive for them to save. Mm. So they get up to the 20% and first-time buyers and something like that would be important for them.
Let me just read some text coming in. Brendan in Dublin says, regarding the property tax, the government should ensure that it keeps its promise that all tax raised from this source would be spent locally. There should be no deviation from this. Fine Gael did so bad, says another texter, because of Enda Kenny's arrogance. He will go down as the worst Fine Gael leader yet. I'm from Mayo. I'm ashamed of him, swanning around from country to country, always ready for the camera. He would want to wake up. Another one, Enda Kenny said on TV in Athlone that jobs were the thing that most brought up on the doorsteps on the canvas. This shows how much he was listening even to his own people. Jer says, incompetent Taoiseach with an incompetent cabinet, with the notable exception of Varadkar and Howland to a lesser extent. So disappointing with lack of quality, but recent by-elections with family seats is certainly one reason. And Tommy in Wicklow says that Nora is right, the Department of Health needs a big shake-up, but the unions are too strong and have too much say, so this shake-up will not happen. Michael, there's some speculation at the moment. Over the last week, I think the BBC mentioned his name twice as being a contender for José Manuel Barroso's job, Enda Kenny. Is that likely?
I don't think it is. And I think he will remain as Taoiseach and leader of Fine Gael. And I think the glittering prize for him domestically is, and it's a possibility, that he will be the first outgoing Fine Gael Taoiseach to lead Fine Gael back into power, which hasn't happened. A lot of people thought in 77 Liam Cosgrave might do it. John Bruton nearly did it, or in a cabinet in which Nora figured in. He almost made it. Garrett, who's hugely popular, didn't do it. And I would think that he will stick with the party and he'll stay as Taoiseach. And I think he sees that as, and it is a possibility, because the next general election is going to be very different to previous general elections. In the past, you had either a Fianna Fáil-led government or a Fine Gael Labour alternative. Next time, people will look at, you either have the existing outgoing government or what? There'll be no obvious alternative. And there, a lot of people, by the way, within Fianna Fáil feel they will need another term in opposition. Number of TDs feel that Sinn Féin, I think, might be in playing maybe a much longer game where they want to establish themselves further in opposition. So people will be wondering, if we vote this government out, what will we replace it with? And this could be to the advantage of the outgoing government.
Mm. At the moment, all across the country, there are our councillors sitting down. I think a lot of the AGMs are tomorrow or next week, sitting down, doing deals as to who's going to be the majority grouping in the councils. And whereas there always was one or two councils where Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil combined to share the Cathaoirleach positions and the mayor positions, I think you're going to find a lot more of those now. And that will change the politics at a ground level where Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and maybe three or four independents are creating the majority on the councils now that have all got bigger. And that will also change the kind of scenario when the next government...
Yeah, in fact,
next government,
Kerry,
you know, the horror that people would have thrown their hands up 10 years ago to say Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael would ever work together has reduced somewhat. I mean, I'm not anticipating that it's going to happen, but I'm just saying that if several councils around the country run their local authorities with a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour and independent kind of mixture, maybe some of those
the legacy of the Civil War will end overnight if the perks of office are evident for those who are joining together in some political alliance.
Tony, but there's a real possibility that many of the backbenchers who were elected, many of the TDs rather, who were elected in 2011 for Fine Gael, won't be re-elected in 2016.
Oh, that's highly likely too as well, with regard, first of all, the numbers of TDs are down by 8, so, and more than likely the government parties are going to lose those 8 seats. And Fine Gael got a bounce, particularly in the last seats in a number of constituencies. I myself got the last seat in Kildare North, an unexpected seat. So there is those sort of things going to happen, and there's going to be the natural swing against the government too as
and
well.
And a huge reduction in senators.
Because
of the council.
So like I suppose all of us in the back benches are feeling that maybe a bit not as optimistic as we were, say, 2 years ago.
And maybe in 2 weeks' time you'll be coming back and speaking as a minister, you know. You won't have to keep saying in the back benches.
A lot of suits were purchased in the January sale in anticipation of ministerial elevation.
I have been saying I'm so far up the back benches that the pigeons don't fly that high.
That's the farmer in you, isn't it, Tony?
Constantine, what do you think about this speculation of Enda Kenny going to Brussels?
I don't know. I think, you know, I don't see Enda Kenny going to Brussels. But then again, Brussels is a very strange place in itself. And the selection process is very convoluted and politically loaded. So we quite often seen before the presidents of the commission come from the behind, from absolutely nowhere, when the front runners were rejected. So that's, you know, a possibility. I think he doesn't have an ambition to do that. And I think he is quintessentially a local politician. So in a sense, he is a backroom politician. So I think he wants to stay and he probably will stay. What worries me is actually not whether Enda Kenny goes to Brussels or not. What worries me is what's going to happen to about 180,000 people who have been on live register for longer than 1 year now. They're permanently unemployed. Once you are that long on the live register, you can't immigrate. You're not going to get a job anywhere else. Mm-hmm. There are 477,000 people in this country who are in receipt of some form of aid in terms of either unemployment or, this is not disability, by the way, this is live register numbers alone. That translates into about, what, roughly 750,000 families, counting for double unemployed families. 750,000 families right now need to have assistance. At the rate we're going right now, the government been running before the elections with the figures, depending on which party you listen to, 60,000 new jobs created, 71,000 new jobs created, I've heard as well. Today's live register figures released, 32,973 is the reduction year on year so far. At this rate, it will take 7 years for us, over 7 years, to just half the live register. Not to bring it down to the pre-crisis levels, to half it. What effectively is happening in the economy...
Just let him finish, Tony.
What effectively is happening in the economy is it's splitting. Younger people with right skills, marketable skills are in demand. We're creating jobs for them. And this is wonderful. That's very important for us because we have young population and we have growing population in that context. Okay, those who don't have skills and those who have fallen on hard times and have been unemployed for long enough, they're being thrown off the bus and left behind. There is no system which is actually going to get for them those jobs. We yet to address that. And we sit here and we talk about rearranging decks on the Titanic. I mean, to be honest, who cares what the cabinet is? As long as this cabinet is not arrogant, connects with people and does something tangible, something real, takes small steps but visible steps and delivers on them. There is no need to have a policy paper on absolutely every side of policy. Just take a couple of things and deliver on them. And then people will start recognizing this government as competent, as promising. And then you can go to the polls and point to the real achievement and not have to fall into the numbers which are conjured out of thin air.
But there's the new gateway proposals that have come from social protection.
But the
where somebody at 22 months unemployed can get so many hours of work and get an increase in their payment. But the idea is to kind of wean them back into, you know, getting up in the morning and going to work. And
It's not them turning down the jobs. It's not that. It's their skills which are not being any more marketed. Let alone, yes, there are psychological effects and there are aptitude effects as well. But it's not about the CV where there is a gap of unemployment of 1 year. What matters is that the skills deteriorate amongst the people. Another thing which matters, and there's some credit to the government during the tenure, there has been improvement in terms of jobs creation in some areas, such as construction, for example. There is a little bit of a pickup. There is quite a bit of a pickup in terms of hospitality sector. Fair play to that. But those jobs are never going to come back in the same levels that we have the legacy of unemployment from. That is a huge problem.
We did lose 300,000 jobs in a very short period of time. There is no silver bullet that's going to create everything. And you have mentioned the fact on the hospitality, the construction. I've mentioned earlier on we should be looking on the house. We have a need for 20 to 25,000 houses to be built on an annual basis in the foreseeable future. So those are the sort of things.
And there's a need for schools to be repaired and rebuilt and all that sort of thing. So you're trying to work towards getting those people. The more people are working, the less unsettlement there is in societies, crime levels drop, health levels improve. I mean, we all know that from the statistics when we're down at 2 and 3% of unemployment. And they say that 2 or 3% are people, you know, at that level who never really will work again. So, I mean, we've all lived, well, Michael has anyway, myself and Michael have lived through where we had 16 and 17% unemployment. We're now at, are we down to 13 now? You know, from 14. 11 today. But I mean, that's a huge number of people. And of course, many of the of our young
but
people.
But as Constantine
have left
said, the difference
country.
Is the debt.
Yes, the debt, and everybody is burdened by the debt. And there are people who, you know, are going to go through this this system of getting their mortgages redeemed and renting the houses and all that sort of thing. And Constantine is a bit depressive about that, saying that it hasn't kind of taken hold. I mean, there are people beginning to get out of that and get themselves above that awful flood.
I'm a director in the largest organisation in this country, which actually helps people with arrears. Believe me, I do know what people look like when they come to us. Mm. And they come to us in larger numbers ever.
Yeah.
There
but,
is
I mean,
a
is
huge
this,
flow
this
of people.
This system that Alan Chatter brought in not working now for
it is
for
not. It's not only it is not working, but this week our organization, for example, announced a major breakthrough in terms of reducing the insolvency period to 3 months. Yeah. It has been agreed between us and the banks directly. The Irish government, with its all benevolence and trying to help the people, has never once actually even entertained an idea of setting the insolvency period short enough. We set 3 years plus 3 year qualification period, effectively 6 year jail for people to financial jail to sit in and work for
it's
the bank.
Half of what it was.
Now, yeah, it was half of what it was, but sure, you know, like, you know, at a certain point in time, they just threw them for life, you know, and sent them off to Australia, you know, so everything is an improvement. However, what I'm saying is that up front, it was known. For example, the pilot that the central bank has run in terms of the resolving unsecured debt, from the up front, it was told. And we were ones of the people who did the submission for the central bank as well and the financial regulator about this, that pilot is not going to work. The government still insisted to proceed with it. It was a resound failure. The central bank effectively almost admitted that it is a failure. It is now shut down and there is no process for working out the problem of unsecured debtors. While just across the water, actually in Northern Ireland, across the border there is a system which works perfectly like a clock, where it is very clear that if you unsecured lender, you take a bath. You walk away from the debt. You're not going to collect that debt. And people can go on with their lives, resolve the problem of the major debt in terms of their properties, and then move on. But in Ireland, there is still not a process. So, and I understand, again, I'll give the government the credit. This is a learning process that they're going through. And there are tweaks and adjustments which need to happen in the process. Fair play. But where are they? Where are those changes?
Tony Lawler.
Yeah, just
where are the changes, Tony?
Well, just to say something, first of all, I think when you mentioned there was two banks earlier on, there's a bit of difficulty and a bit of confusion. KBC have come out and said there has been no agreement. So there's a bit of confusion from that side. Yes, a lot of the legislation that we brought in, new reforming type legislation, there is time for some of us to review it, look at the measures that are in place. We do need to, as Constantina says, tweak some of the things, analyse where we need to go right, because this is a work in progress. We've come on considerably in the last 3 years. We still have to listen to the people. Government has to listen to us at backbenchers. But there is opportunities for us in a positive
way. And Michael, having listened to all the figures that Constantine has given there, do you still think Enda Kenny would be re-elected in 2016?
Can I come back to 2016, Audrey?
We'll leave it there.
I think there's a possibility. I wouldn't write the political obituary of this government at all, despite the trouble they have had.
Thank you all very much.
We need to see some changes in the next few weeks.
Nora Owen, Constantine Gurdjieff, Michael O'Regan and Tony Lawler, thank you all very much. Back on Tuesday at 10. Till then, from all of us, have a lovely weekend.
The Late Debate with Audrey Carvel was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher is Richie Byrne. And sound supervision tonight was by Pather Carney.